It's impossible to talk about life as we know it without talking about water and acknowledging water. We all know the strength of water. This week of all weeks, and the recent anniversary of Katrina and with Ike, we know what water can do in the negative sense. We know that water can sweep in over the oceans, falling from the skies, come in forms of waves, destroying homes, destroying jobs, destroying lives. We know also that water is a source of life, that we can't live long without it. We know that the seas are a source of life, giving us fish and shellfish and food of all different kinds. We are water-based entities. Star Trek, they talk about carbon-based, but we really are H2O. We are all about water. And when you look at the history and the scriptures of humanity, you see the importance of this remarkable stuff chronicled. What happens in the beginning of creation? I know everybody picks up with the "let there be light," but something happened before the "let there be light," and that something was the Spirit moved on the face of the waters. And the waters were chaos, as I confirmed with Dennis before the service, chaos being the Greek word for chaos. The Hebrew word being tohu vahu. The chaos that is ordered in the act of creation. And that's a strong metaphor, because when you really look deeply at the scriptures in the beginning and actually throughout both Hebrew scriptures and Christian gospels, you see the importance of water. You see the ambivalence, the two natures of water. That of chaos and striking fear into people's hearts, that waves could come, floods could come down the wadis, and people would be drowned. Floods could not come. Maybe the Nile would not flood and you would have no crops. They understood their connection to water, to the force of it, to the strength of it. I remember so well that I have sense memory of the first time I dropped into a wave body surfing as a young person and felt the entire ocean and its energy lift me and throw me, not in chaos, but down the face of this wave. And the sense of connection to a power infinitely beyond my comprehension and my control. But for a moment, I was united by it, lifted by it, thrown by it, part of it. That is the strength of water and the strength of life. When you look again at the scriptures in a pre-biblical creation story, God wrestles the water for 5 days of creation. The sea is not something inert. It is active, it is contentious, it is chaotic. It is a symbol of chaos and death. When you look at the Exodus story, you might well wonder, well, why do they part the waters? Why not just build a bridge or walk around, take a boat? Because controlling water in Hebrew scriptures was controlling the chaos inside and the fear inside. It wasn't conquering death, it was conquering fear. When you look again at the Exodus and Moses going across the Sinai and there wasn't any water, and he strikes a rock and water comes out. This is a symbol of finding nourishment, finding sustenance, even in the most arid of lands. And as I was talking about earlier during the joys and sorrows, finding sustenance and healing even in the most arid and barren seeming of lives. When you go on and look at the Christian scriptures and gospels, you see, what does Jesus say? He says, I am living water. You drink and you're still thirsty, I'm going to give you water that's going to nourish not your body, but your soul. And then there's a little bit of marketing when he plays a one-upsmanship game. And with Moses, you get water. And with Jesus, you get wine. And I see this really as a form of marketing. Galileo, however, did say that water is the way, wine is the way that water captures sunlight. Isn't that a nice line? I'm going to go home and take a sunbath as soon as I get there. I think it's probably going to be a Cabernet. It is symbolic of the wrestling of the chaos that and the creativity of the chaos that all of us live through and experience. That water is, as our lives are, a changeable kind of material. I won't call it an element because I'll get corrected. But water takes on the form of solid, of liquid, and of vapor. It's really remarkable in how it changes. And our lives are built around all of these things that water can do. I know that this sounds awfully religious and sounds like an argument from design, but just celebrate it. And that is, if our planet were closer to the sun, all water would be vapor. If we were much further away, all water would be ice. We live in a world where we can live because water can change. Because the water that slakes our thirst is returned in several different forms into the atmosphere, into the ground, into the aquifer, into the rivers, into the lakes. It changes into vapor and is taken up into the sky and into clouds. It becomes rain and snow and sleet and snowpack, and it is stored in our mountains and released again into the rivers, into a cycle that we are a part of. And it is its ability to change shape, consistency, viscosity, all of those things that makes human life and life as we know it possible on this planet. There is no more precious element. As we look at this water with its salts, we know that the ocean, Okeanos, is the mother of the gods to the Greeks. That we know that we came from the ocean. Isn't it remarkable that in the scriptures, they essentially get the order of evolution right? This is why I always get confused when fundamentalists and scientists argue about the issue of evolution and creationism. Essentially, the Bible gets the scientific story right. Is it a coincidence? Was it preternatural wisdom? I don't know. But you had light, you had ocean, you had life in the ocean, and then life coming out of the ocean, first as plants, then as animals. And you can see the evolution of the animals in the story of Genesis. It's all there, and it's one of those examples where we find some reason to fight that we really don't have to. It's two different pieces of poetry, two different symphonies, and we argue about which one is the right one. But what's remarkable is all of these things that water does and how important it is to life and how precious and fragile life is. Is and how dependent we are on this water and how we have always known it from the beginning of every religion. They have understood just how central water is to us. Now, we all know the business about your 92% water and Doug Adams' great line about how human life is just a trick that water created to get carried from one place to another, and all of those are kind of nice images and jokes. But the essential mystery is around that water. We are filled with it. We are filled with it, and the seas, the primordial seas, we can taste in our tears. It's one of the theories of why people kiss, is to get the salt and to touch and taste and time travel and have a communion with those primordial seas. The same percentage of salts are in our blood. They create life. We pull these minerals out, we pull these salts out, and we can't live. It is a remarkable and delicate balance, that a dance that we do as human beings with water. And water, which in some ways should be so simple to care for, to take, to enjoy, is actually a terribly complex issue, and I know this treads on issues of politics, but water is the oil of the 21st century. Who is going to have the water? Who's going to have it for agriculture? How is that water going to be purified? What will it carry of chemicals from industrial plants, of chemicals and fertilizers from agricultural plants, of the waste from animals, into the aquifers, into the rivers, into the oceans, and into us? Those are critical issues. Who owns the water? Who controls the water? What happens upstream and what happens downstream? Now, this is not new stuff. Again, I'm going to take you back to the Bible and the story of why there was a tremendous prejudicial view against cities in Hebrew scriptures up until the time of David. Cities were anathema. They were scary places. And they were scary places because when you had concentrations of people, you could have concentrations of diseases. You could have a fouling of the water. What happened upriver came downriver. And if your settlement was downriver, your settlement could be wiped out in a moment from one sick person upriver. They understood that. And that's one of the great conflicts between the settled communities and the nomadic communities. The nomadic communities kept moving, trying to stay away from all of the problems of illness and of human waste. These are ancient problems that we are wrestling with, and we're getting pinned. We are not winning this struggle with water and with cleanliness and with the human right to have clean water. It's estimated by reputable people that if we act as we have acted in the past, some 135 million preventable deaths will take place between now and the year 2020. If we act responsibly, we can reduce that to between 8 and 15 million preventable deaths from water, dirty water, absence of clean water. Malaria, yellow fever, dysentery are the largest killers of children in the world. Not bombs, not wars, but dirty water and dehydration. There are things that are going on in terms of water that are shocking. Some of you who are faithful readers of the Fullerton Observer know that in Fullerton itself there are tremendous problems with dirty water and what's happened in the aquifers from some less enlightened times. And what is that going to do, and will there be cancer clusters, and what are we doing to ourselves? There was a time when most people who were middle class laughed at the rich for wasting money buying bottled water and shook their heads at the poor, who mostly came from countries that did not have clean potable water, who were spending their little money on bottled water. And now people aren't laughing anymore, because you cannot presume upon the safety of water. Another article in the Fullerton Observer, I'm quoting myself now, please forgive me, it was about the whole toilet to tap business. And one of the things that people have found out in studying clean city water, and that is, we can make it safe against the bacteria. You won't get anything really terrible. But we are not spending the money to make it safe against the pharmaceuticals that are in the water. And so they are testing, claiming that it isn't therapeutic level, but they are testing water and finding huge amounts. And what I really like about this is that different cities have different markers. So that in San Francisco, they are finding a lot of sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, Viagra, and Cialis. So in case any of you are planning trips, you'll understand. In New York, which is really strange to me, they are finding very high residue of caffeine. It's like New Yorkers aren't nervous enough. They have to take the water in order to get more caffeine. Los Angeles is anti-anxiety medication. What are we doing? I mean, this is one of those things. Are we crazy? And the answer is, by the way, yes. So drink some more Los Angeles water. You'll still be crazy, but you won't be as anxious about it. This is actually serious stuff. Water is life. It's life on this planet. And I think that clean water is a human right. And the changing of water into a private model where water becomes, now this is not just a United States kind of problem, but all across the third world, private corporations are trying to tie up the market in water. This is tying up the market in life. It's very important that we be engaged in understanding how important it is, in understanding that there is only one water. That wherever you go on this planet, you will find pharmaceuticals, you will find deep DDT. Not that pharmaceuticals are evil or DDT is evil, but what we are putting into the water is being recycled through the entire chain of life. This is a problem that has been understood since ancient times, and we always had the sense that the seas were big enough that we could do anything, that the lakes were deep enough that we could do anything, that the aquifers would purify the water, that the water that was held in glaciers and in the snowpack would eventually be clean enough for us to live and to thrive. This is no longer a safe assumption. We need to be involved in wrestling with the chaos of water policy. We need to be involved in understanding that we can't have clean water and ship the dirty water, and the affluent can't ship the effluent to the poor. It will come back. It will recycle. You don't have to make a choice to recycle water. You will recycle water. It is what do we do in the meantime? Now, I know this is awfully close, where are you sitting, Jim Antonow, to what we call in the trade a central city sewer sermon. But it's about bigger things than that. It is about appreciating just how precious and just how fragile life is, and the fact that we have power to make a difference. It begins with awareness that we don't escape, that every drop of water is attached to every other drop of water eventually. And as it cycles from the hard form of ice to the form of vapor, which is breath, and then to liquid, it passes through these stages, our lives pass through these stages, and now is the time, if we are to drink deeply of life, to do our part, to understand the precious connection we have with water. We celebrate it, we lift it up, we change it and flavor it with coffee, with fruit, we make it into wine. We do all kinds of things with it. What I am asking is that we become conscious and intentional around what water is. It is more than an issue of simply trying to save water to lower our bills. It is about the quality of water. It is more than simply trying to save our lives. It is about the quality of our lives. It is understanding that chaos has always been, as it was in Genesis 1, an opportunity for divine and for human, as however we understand that, to be involved with shaping some sense of order out of the chaos. Order that represents our intentions, our consciousness, and our values. We are more powerful than we dream, and we are also more vulnerable than we can imagine, and we can, by choice, affect both of those states.